1290 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. The TSA says it screened more than 2.9 million air travelers on Friday, its fourth busiest day ever. This woman in Denver told KMGH things were smooth.
It's been super easy. Like, no hiccups, no trouble. There's no lines at security. I got right in, checked my bag. Super smooth.
Millions of travelers hoping to say the same through July 8th. The TSA in that period expects to screen more than 32 million people, an increase of over 5% from a year ago. President Biden set to attend fundraisers today. Prominent Democrats have lined up in support of his reelection bid, despite his struggles during Thursday's debate. The Supreme Court did not rule on former President Trump's bid for absolute criminal immunity Friday. That ruling is expected Monday. And the prosecution rested its case in the corruption trial of Senator Bob Menendez. The defense will make its argument beginning Monday. This is ABC News. ABC's Chuck Sievertson. The Supreme Court ruled Friday an Oregon City's rule banning people from sleeping outside in public spaces does not constitute cruel and unusual punishment. Meanwhile, in Los Angeles, new numbers indicate that for the first time in 6 years, efforts to battle homelessness appear to be working.
For years, Los Angeles has been trying to figure out how to deal with a ballooning homelessness crisis. There are tents all over streets here in L.A. Efforts have been underway to get homeless into shelters, and police have cleared out encampments. A new federally mandated count found 75,312 people are homeless in L.A. County on any given night. That is down about 0.3%. L.A.'s mayor, who declared an emergency over homelessness, is calling it the beginning of change. Alex Stone, ABC News, Los Angeles.
The Iranian election to replace the late President Ibrahim Raisi produced the lowest turnout in Iran's history, and nobody secured a clear majority. There will be a runoff on Friday. I'm Brian Clark, ABC News.
Look up cheese curds. You'll find this basic definition: wet pieces of curdled milk.
Huh?
Well, it should also include the word delicious. As we continue to celebrate June Dairy Month, do you know how much milk is needed to make 1 pound of cheese curds? 16 ounces, 64 ounces, or 160 ounces, 10 pounds of milk? The answer coming up.
It actually is a sound of freshness.
Rachel Kerr is talking about squeaky curds. She's with the Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin and a bit of a cheese nerd.
Those elastic protein strands rub against the enamel of your teeth and create that characteristic sound.
The squeak turns stretchy when battered and deep fried. Some believe the idea to fry globs of cheese happened by accident. I consider it a happy accident. Okay, did you guess? It takes 10 pounds of milk, which is a big gallon jug plus a little bit more, to make 1 pound of squeaky cheese curds. Call me your curd girl for this slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News, your news roundup in quick podcast form. You can find it anywhere at the WGBW website, wgbw.fm.
I'm Terry Bell. Top line indicators show the economy is doing well, even if some Americans are feeling pessimistic. Mike Mohn spoke with a public union leader who credits federal policy for better times.
John Havlicek has been teaching in the Cross for a quarter century. Havlicek, also a union leader, says he's seen how the Biden administration's efforts on student loan forgiveness are having a positive impact on his colleagues. One way is through home ownership, which he says is out of reach for many in the field.
That's just not conducive to getting the best and the brightest into our classrooms. So the student loan forgiveness then is a huge deal, because that's $200, $300, $400, $500 a month would be freed up for folks to spend elsewhere on something like a house.
He wants policymakers to get even more creative, suggesting a federal match to get states to boost education spending. Havlicek says new federal investments in infrastructure and clean energy have helped local universities and hospitals expand. Havlicek says jobs tied to public works projects in his area are strengthening public unions after Wisconsin Republicans have tried to weaken them in recent decades. That includes the repeal of state prevailing wage laws. He says workers now are benefiting from labor standards and training included in policies like the Inflation Reduction Act.
These are high-paying jobs, and when we couple that with the technical college, these folks can get their training. and they can raise families. They then, you know, buy their groceries. They go out for dinner.
Havlicek says it's important to have these new career pathways as La Crosse's population becomes more diverse. La Crosse has seen a nearly 70% increase in Latino residents since 2010. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Perry Bell.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, chance of a shower or thunderstorm, otherwise sunshine and breezy with a high near 82. Clear 52 tonight, sunshine 73 for your Sunday. Low 70s again Monday with mostly sunny skies. Slight chance of a shower or thunderstorm Monday night into Tuesday.
It's 76 at our studios.
Todd Albaugh.
Hey everybody, join us next time as we take a look back at what happened over the weekend and get you prepared for July 4th. Join us.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2. You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Jim Santel, and I am your host, yes, for this second hour in our Saturday morning broadcast, continuing in a special section of Amicus, a law review, tomorrow afternoon from 2 to 4, as we continue to march through some of these major decisions issued by our United States Supreme Court, already having talked about this case involving SEC and Mr. Jarchese, finding that after decades of operation, the SEC now needs to afford anyone who is appealing internally to the SEC determinations about civil judgments entitled now to a jury trial under the Seventh Amendment to the Constitution, changing dramatically not only the way in which the SEC works, but also arguably many, many other agencies that in their own internal adjudication of claims by residents, by citizens, by people of the United States of America, as all of this goes forward now, needed to be afforded a jury trial, which will have the potential, arguably, to slow down not only the process by which these agencies make decisions, but also remove from the SEC and arguably these other agencies the very authority that is at the core of this seeming attack on something that does not exist, which is the deep administrative state. We know, in fact, and I know from having worked for 30 or more years inside the federal government, working on behalf of the people of the United States of America, clients in these agencies, they are good people. They are responsible. They are entitled to some deference. Are they perfect? Absolutely not. Do we, on a routine basis, have to correct some decisions that are made? Yes, indeed. And we do that judicially. They do that administratively when mistakes are made. They're not perfect. But they are the experts, and I would say that the great majority of time in which they are resolving these claims and differences of opinion between individuals and the agencies, they get it right. Why? Because they're the experts. They know what they're talking about. Now, inside the SEC, we're going to have decisions by juries, again, people who are called in from the communities. We embrace the jury system in many ways. We embrace the jury system on the appellate level after the SEC and these other agencies are done with the more efficient and more expert-based analysis that they've been doing. A major change in that case, SEC versus Jarchese. And now the big one, now the very big one that changes quite literally the way that government works in America. This again, Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo, the Secretary of Commerce. The Supreme Court deciding in a case authored by the Chief Justice that the Administrative Procedures Act, the APA, requires courts to exercise their independent judgment in deciding whether an agency has acted within its statutory authority, the statutory authority given to it by the Congress. And courts may not defer, and there is that all-important word, courts may not defer to an agency interpretation of a law simply because the statute is ambiguous. Chevron, this principle around since 1984, expressly overruled. A major opinion, and I commend to everyone the reading of the majority opinion. It is important to understand it. It is long. It is nearly 40 pages in length, about 35 altogether. And I also commend the review and analysis of the dissent. And Elena Kagan in particular, writing, as I said, in our first hour this morning about the court not adopting the fundamental processes that it normally does when it comes to overruling precedent. She says its justification comes down in the end to this. Courts must have more say over regulation, over the provision, all these other areas of our common life. A longstanding precedent, she writes, at the crux of administrative governments, thus falls victim to a bald assertion of judicial authority. She talks about this notion that this is somehow unworkable, and yet the majority unable to identify what has been unworkable in the last 40 years. Majority, she says, disdains restraint and grasps for power. It illustrates the stability of Chevron in practice when courts apply it in good faith to the panoply out there of technical questions that arise when agencies do, in fact, apply a broadly worded mandate to a specific problem. Chevron has worked. Chevron has worked. And it is not to say, Chevron does not say, that courts defer completely to agency determinations. Implicit, explicit in Chevron is this notion that federal judges adopt and follow the decisions of the people who know what they're talking about if those decisions are on their face reasonable and rational. And as to Roberts' claim that Chevron is some kind of a decaying husk, those are his words, because the Supreme Court has not applied it in 8 years, Elena Kagan provides a response to that as well. And again, further supports this notion that this particular Chevron doctrine has been targeted by the Supreme Court for many years, not only in cases dropping the suggestion that this should be abandoned, but also in various statements and speeches and writings by members of the Supreme Court, well beyond their casework as well. She writes the majority's argument that the a particular application inside of the Supreme Court of Chevron has not been applied in 8 years, although in many, many other cases before that. She says it's a bootstrap. And she said the court has avoided applying Chevron since 2016, her words in the dissent, because it has been preparing to overrule Chevron since around that time. That kind of self-help on the way to reversing precedent has become almost routine at this court, she writes. Stop applying a decision where one should. Throw some gratuitous criticisms into a couple of opinions. Issue a few separate writings questioning the decision's premises. Give the whole process a few years, and voila, you have a justification for overruling the decision. That's what Elena Kagan writes on behalf of the minority, the dissenting parties. This overruling through enfeeblement technique, she writes, mocked the stare decisis principle upon which our courts proceed on a regular basis. The significance of this particular opinion cannot be overstated. As I've indicated before on this broadcast and others, when the court first identified its 62 cases or so that are on its docket for this term, many of us identified this particular matter at the top of the list. And it was only when the Supreme Court on April 25th began to entertain seriously the notion that somehow a president can commit crimes while in the Oval Office that many of us, including me, began to think that this Loper-Bright Enterprises now holds a secondary spot to the significance of that immunity decision that will be issued on Monday. Even in the wake of the issuance of this opinion in Loper-Bright Enterprises, I am reconsidering that assessment. Regardless of what the Supreme Court does in the immunity case on Monday, a huge case, we will talk about it next week as we also invite your questions and comments on all of this. As we talk about what the immunity justices do in resolving this claim by Donald Trump, it will become clear, I believe, that regardless of what the Supreme Court does in that particular case, that the long-term and short-term impact of the decision to get rid of Chevron, to basically tell the administrative agencies that they can no longer exercise the thoughtful, experience-based discretion that they've been exercising on behalf of America, that make the system go, that make government work, that decision, which we received just this past week from a majority of the Supreme Court, as Elena Kagan said, changing dramatically, hugely, the way in which our government works going forward. And it will change the ways in which not just the fisheries entity, this fisheries agency works when it comes to deciding who pays and who doesn't pay for the monitors on their boats. Again, a ruling, a decision, an issue basically withdrawn by the Biden administration. Even putting that to one side, the larger issue here remains. And that is a distrust fundamentally of administrative agencies and of civil servants who, again, are doing the work of America in an arguably imperfect way. They're not perfect, but they do, in fact, apply their best insights, their experience, their education. And when they get it wrong, there is a remedy for that, that is going into the federal court. And at that point, getting a jury trial, getting a court to decide these cases, it is an acknowledgement inside a majority of the Supreme Court that we do not trust experts. We do not trust the people who are educated. And instead, we're going to take into ourselves the decision-making authority that, for example, Judge Kaczmarek in Texas took upon himself. In this case we talked about earlier in our broadcast, this mifepristone case in which the judge decided not to follow 25 years of FDA decision-making and testing and responsible determination that that particular drug is safe and secure as a drug can be, and instead substituted his own view about the efficacy of that drug. The Supreme Court, in the end, overturning that decision, but not on substantive grounds, finding that you've got the wrong plaintiffs in that case, in a standing case. But the initial decision there is a reflection by Judge Kaczmarek of this notion that it is federal judges now who should make these decisions and not the experts in our government. Our government has worked this way successfully for well over 40 years now. Now, in the wake of Loper Bright Enterprises and the decision by the Supreme Court, our government has changed. And it is one of those cases that, regrettably, is very wonky. It is very academic. When people talk about a principle like Chevron being overruled, sometimes eyes rolled. I would offer that not only should everybody read the majority opinion, digest that. Everybody should read the dissenting opinion as well. Make a determination on your own about the merits and the demerits of this decision. But no, regardless of how you may come down on this particular case, regardless of how you feel about the dissent and the majority opinions here, government has changed. Government will change in the future, and it will change in connection with the way in which citizens of our nation interact with many, many agencies in all areas of our lives. The significance of Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo, decided on June 28th of 2024, cannot be overstated in our lifetime. We have some additional time, obviously, in this second hour to continue our march through these major cases. We've talked about these two major agency cases already. Let's move on into another one also involving an agency, but this one having to do with pollution and a decision made by the Supreme Court in a case called Ohio versus Environmental Protection Agency. The case here questioning whether an executive branch, in particular the Biden administration, can enforce a so-called good neighbor plan, a good neighbor plan applicable about 23 states and factories and power plants in Western and Midwestern states to cut ozone pollution that drifts into Eastern states. The Clean Air Act at play here in this particular case empowers the states to devise their own anti-pollution protocols, the rules and regulations by which they keep the air above us, the air that we breathe, safe and secure. The EPA determining here that the plans as announced by these states failed to comply with certain standards, some revised standards by the EPA. And so what happens is the Supreme Court temporarily puts a hold on Thursday of that EPA plan to curtail air pollution. We'll talk more about exactly what the Supreme Court did and did not do when we come back here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
I'm Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I learned about atrial fibrillation the hard way. My symptoms would come and go, shortness of breath, fatigue. I kept going. Then I got so lightheaded, I couldn't. My doctor said I have AFib, so I'm about five times more likely to have a stroke. Other symptoms, irregular heartbeat, heart racing, chest pain, can come and go, but the risk of stroke stays. If you have symptoms, tell a doctor Visit notimetowait.com.
Sponsored by Bristol-Myers Squibb and Pfizer.
Do you know or work with kids who have special healthcare needs? Help them live their best lives. Contact Wisconsin Wayfinder Children's Resource Network. Our specialists will connect you with services in your area. Wisconsin Wayfinder is free and confidential. Call 877-947-2929 or visit dhs.wi.gov/wiscway. Connect today. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Department of Health Services.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
This is Amicus, the Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this hour, and yes, additional hours tomorrow afternoon as we continue to analyze these major cases, 10 of them all together, 10 cases decided by our United States Supreme Court just this past week. Talking right now about Ohio and Indiana and West Virginia, all sorts of states and other entities suing the Environmental Protection Agency based upon the administration's Good Neighbor Plan. It was meant to protect downwind states from harmful air emissions. Supreme Court on Thursday temporarily puts on hold this environmental EPA plan to curtail air pollution that drifts across state lines. And that's the key. That's the basic concept in this case. And it is, in fact, another blow to the administration's efforts to protect the environment. We have seen this in the past terms of the Supreme Court, restrictions on the capacity of the EPA to implement the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and other things. This is yet another one of them involving another agency. And under this particular proposal of the EPA, this particular agency is known as the Good Neighbor Plan. Factories and power plants in Western and also Midwestern states have to cut their ozone pollution that drifts by the virtue of the fact that we have prevailing westerlies in our nation into these eastern states. The emissions cause smog and are sometimes linked to asthma and lung disease and sometimes even premature death. Now, significantly, the ruling here was provisional. By that, I mean that it is not in place permanently. But even the temporary loss for the administration will suspend this particular plan for many months and even longer as the dissent, which we'll talk about, also focuses. The vote was 5 to 4, a majority 5-4. Writing for the majority, you've got Justice Neil Gorsuch, said that the court's ruling here is modest. He is pausing the administration's plan in light of developments in lower courts. He said the Supreme Court's stay would remain in place while a federal appeals court in Washington considered the matter, and after that, until the Supreme Court acts on any appeal. Now, significantly, beyond that majority opinion that basically puts a temporary hold on the EPA decision in this case, one of the other reasons why this is a fascinating matter to look at and to digest as we think about the members of our Supreme Court is you've got Amy Coney Barrett, who is joined by the three so-called liberal members of the court, issuing a very spirited, almost scathing dissent that predicted that the majority had created a years-long exercise in futility. This is Amy Coney Barrett writing. We know from some of our previous discussions that Amy Coney Barrett has already begun to drift dramatically and explicitly from this notion that when we decide about the legitimacy of statutes and of things that are being done in our government, this look back to history and tradition, while it provides a legitimate basis initially for determining what has happened, it cannot be the final answer. And she takes on Clarence Thomas in particular in the guns area, in the intellectual property area, other areas, when she says that this exclusive reliance upon the past is not a proper way to understand the present. And she seems to be drifting more and more away from some of her conservative allies and her conservative colleagues on the Supreme Court. Here she joins Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, and Ketanji Brown Jackson in writing the dissent, which the others concur in, suggesting that what the Supreme Court has done here is accomplishing this years-long exercise in futility. She says this: given the number of companies included and the timelines for review, and again, this is Amy Coney Barrett writing in dissent here, the court's injunction leaves large swaths of upwind states free to keep contributing significantly to their downwind neighbors' ozone problems for for the next several years. She's concerned about what's going to happen while all of this is pending. She called one argument set out in the majority opinion a feeble response to that concern about timing. Another, she said, throws at the wall a cherry-picked assortment of EPA statements, and then goes on to say, none stick. All of that coming from Amy Coney Barrett. Under the Clean Air Act, as I indicated, the states are in fact allowed appropriately. Again, a decision by the Congress to establish this Clean Air Act, administered by what? By the Environmental Protection Agency. This is how our government has worked. Subject to approval by the FDA, states are in fact allowed to devise their own plans. And that's what happened here. In February of 2023, the agency concluded, based upon, again, the experts inside those agencies, that about 23 states had not produced adequate plans, sufficiently aggressive, if you will, to comply with its revised ozone standards, hadn't met what the EPA had put in place. The agency then issued its own decisions, its own standards in all of this, and this litigation followed. Seven appeals courts blocked the EPA's disapproval of those plans, and about 11 states subject to the federal rule in the wake of all of that litigation. This has been going on for a long time. All of that was significant. Again, going back to the majority opinion and giving it its way, Justice Gorsuch writing in the majority opinion, together, these 12 states accounted for over 70% of the emissions EPA had planned to address. This is what he's writing in the majority opinion, which also is worth your reading and worth your consumption. The question, Justice Gorsuch wrote, was what happens when many of the upwind states are no longer governed by the federal plan, and it may now cover only a fraction of the states and emissions EPA anticipated? He asked that as a rhetorical question. The answer, he said, was to put the federal plan on hold. And once again, he's in agreement, not only obviously with his own writing, but you've got Chief Justice John Roberts, Clarence Thomas, Sam Alito, Brett Kavanaugh joining that majority opinion. Amy Coney Barrett writes back. She says that the stays issued by the lower courts, about which Justice Gorsuch writes, of this agency disapproval of these state plans were really not significant. While the plans, she says, have been temporarily stayed, this again is Amy Coney Barrett, no court has yet invalidated one. So she responds to Associate Justice in the majority opinion here. There was, moreover, she said, good reason to think that EPA's methodology for calculating cost-effectiveness thresholds and imposing emission controls did not depend on the number of covered states. All of that in a very spirited dissent, almost scathing when it comes to understanding what Amy Coney Barrett and the others think about the decision to temporarily hold the EPA's plan to curtail air pollution. The three states in this case, Ohio, Indiana, West Virginia, had challenged this plan directly in the D.C. circuit. D.C. three-judge panel there refused to suspend the rule. That's when the Supreme Court stepped in, and that's when we have this particular decision coming out of the Supreme Court just this past week. Justice Barrett, again, goes on to say the court today enjoins the enforcement of a major environmental protection agency rule based upon an undeveloped theory that is unlikely to succeed on the merits. In so doing, the court grants emergency relief in a fact-intensive and highly technical case without fully engaging with both the relevant law and voluminous record. Those are strong words. She finally writes, the challengers cannot satisfy the stringent conditions for relief in this posture. A divided court, an interestingly divided court, in this case involving the EPA, another major agency decision, the Supreme Court temporarily stopping the EPA from doing what it's doing, obviously anticipating the case will come back in the future. When we continue, yet more from our United States Supreme Court this past week, more analysis right here on Amicus, a Law Review.
This is the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. The TSA says it screened more than 2.9 million air travelers on Friday, its fourth busiest day ever. This woman in Denver told KMGH things were smooth.
It's been super easy. Like, no hiccups, no trouble. There's no lines at security. I got right in, checked my bag. Super smooth.
Millions of travelers hoping to say the same through July 8th. The TSA in that period expects to screen more than 32 million people, an increase of over 5% from a year ago. President Biden set to attend fundraisers today. Prominent Democrats have lined up in support of his reelection bid, despite his struggles during Thursday's debate. The Supreme Court did not rule on former President Trump's bid for absolute criminal immunity Friday. That ruling is expected Monday. And the prosecution rested its case in the corruption trial of Senator Bob Menendez. The defense will make its argument beginning Monday. This is ABC News.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed. Keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
Another Brewers Grand Slam. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewers beat the Cubs 4-2 here at American Family Field. Three Brewers have now hit Grand Slams this week. Rhys Hoskins, Jake Bauer, and this time it was rookie Jackson Churio, bottom of the fourth on Bally Sports Wisconsin.
The 1-2, Churio in the air. Left field.
It's Churio's first career Grand Slam. Pat Murphy on the 20-year-old's progress.
You've watched it. You know, the kid is learning, and he's made the most of his opportunities lately, and you can see why, you know, our people decided to sign him long term.
The Cubs fall to 38-45 on the season and remain in last place. Cubs manager Craig Counsell.
I think we got to plan on scoring more runs. You know, we've got to score more runs. No question about it. That's a part of this for sure.
Again, the Brewers with a 4-2 win from American Family Field with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, chance of a shower or thunderstorm, otherwise sunshine and breezy with a high near 82. Clear 52 tonight, sunshine 73 for your Sunday. Low 70s again Monday with mostly sunny skies. Slight chance of a shower or thunderstorm Monday night into Tuesday.
It's 76 at our studios.
Hi, this is Jim Schmidt, your former mayor of Green Bay. You know, I've always cared about local issues. I still do. Join me on my new show, Lean Local, here on WGBW. I'll interview community leaders and elected officials, discuss the economy and development projects, and we'll talk about the future of education here in Greater Green Bay. As they say, all politics is local. So join me for Lean Local, Sunday at 1 p.m. on the Talk of Green Bay, 97.9 WGBW.
Donald Trump brags he nominated the justices who overturned Roe v. Wade, getting rid of the constitutional right to abortion.
Well, I did something that nobody thought was possible. I got rid of Roe v. Wade. For 54 years, they were trying to get Roe v. Wade terminated, and I did it, and I'm proud to have done it.
Donald Trump not only took away abortion rights, he wants to monitor pregnant women and punish those who seek an abortion. Just listen.
Do you believe in punishment for abortion, yes or no, as a principle?
The answer is that there has to be some form of punishment.
For the woman?
Yeah.
Banning abortion, monitoring and punishing women. That's how far Trump might go in a second term. Visit abetterwisconsintogether.org/TrumpMonitor to tell Donald Trump his views on abortion are too extreme for Wisconsin. Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together, Inc.
Matt Nair on air.
It is Wisconsin. We need to have some kind of presidential debate drinking game. What is the cue?
Is it rigged? Is it? Come on, man.
Malarkey, though.
I think
malarkey is like a 5-point word.
Yeah, that's the one ring to rule them all. That is the one you want to get. I feel like he will switch some voters if he does malarkey because it's just so darn charming.
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Crude and Dom.
Tune in Monday for the Trump immunity ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll find out if Joe Biden's got SEAL Team 6 on speed dial.
The Devil's Advocates. Weekdays 4 till 6.
This is Amicus, a Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. I'm your host for this, the remaining portion of our second hour here on Saturday, June 29th. We are marching through the great number of Supreme Court cases, 10 decisions altogether, actually 9 opinions, because the Loper-Bright Enterprises case also involving a case involving Relentless. It's the same issue. Those were consolidated, and so we're getting 10 opinions, even though there are basically 9 different issues here altogether, talking also about social media. In addition to the cases we've already discussed, the Supreme Court has also decided to take this term at least 2 social media cases, some other cases involving free speech, these having to do with social media online platform providers in particular. And we know that on Monday, the Supreme Court, in addition to issuing this major decision having to do with whether or not a president is immune from prosecution for crimes that he, one day she, may commit in the Oval Office, making that major decision, that release on Monday, we know that they're also going to decide another case involving social media. And that one, that case, involves decisions by the legislatures of 2 southern states to compel media providers, social media providers, platform providers, to engage in certain restrictions on the ways in which they can control content. Content moderation is the term. The question is whether or not legislatures, state legislatures, can dictate to online providers, social media providers, in the public forums, what they can and cannot post and cannot take down in particular. Those social media providers, those platform providers, engage in content moderation all the time. And routinely, when there are things that are overtly offensive and that are simply demonstrably wrong, they will take those down. We know that that happens with great regularity because they are controlling and they're patrolling themselves, if you will, to ensure that their legitimacy as private entities, but nonetheless, entities that the public can rely upon not to be inappropriate, not to be purveyors of inaccurate information. They engage in internal content moderation all the time. The legislatures in these 2 southern states have told them, in many ways, direct and indirect, they cannot do that anymore. If they do decide to take something down off of a platform, something that is posted, they have to justify it in every single case, a hugely burdensome process. That's the legislation that is now before the Supreme Court. We're going to hear what the Supreme Court says about that. Fairly clear that based upon the oral argument in that case a while back, that the United States Supreme Court, a majority at least, is not going to buy into, not going to support the decision by these legislatures to restrict what private social media providers can in fact do and not do. Basically going to strike down those pieces of state legislation as illegal, unconstitutional, not appropriate exercises of legislative authority. But we'll see. And we can never know for certain until the Supreme Court actually decides the case. That is one of the cases coming out on Monday. The other one, once again, this major immunity case. I tell you all of that because the Supreme Court just this past week did decide the other social media case. And this one also relates to the intersection, the relationship between government and social media providers. The Supreme Court did, in fact, just this past Wednesday, rejected a challenge that sought to prevent the government, and in particular the present administration, from contacting social media platforms, the providers out there, to combat what it said was misinformation. Misinformation basically in 2 basic areas. 1, again, incendiary, wildly offensive things that are contrary to basic ways in which we as a civilized nation and civilized world should talk about each other and with each other and to each other. And 2, misinformation in the sense of providing just things that are downright wrong. And in particular, advising, for example, about remedies for COVID-19, that are demonstrably not accurate and wrong and medically unsupported, and also suggesting, more than suggesting, establishing and advocating online that the 2020 election, the presidential election, was stolen. Also a matter of factual inaccuracy. And so the Biden administration reaches out to these social media platforms and says, you know, you've got things on your postings there that are misinformation. They're wrong. They're misleading. They are inaccurate when it comes to the facts of what happened in 2020. And they're contrary to the safety and security of our nation when it comes to people advocating for certain medicinal responses to COVID-19. Those are dangerous. The administration says you should take them down. The court just this past week ruled that states and users who had challenged those interactions, again, between the administration and these social media providers had not in fact suffered the sort of direct injury that gave them, here we go once again, standing to sue. Decision by a 6-3 vote left for another day as some of the fundamental questions about what limits the First Amendment imposes on government's power to influence the technology companies that are the main gatekeepers. But in this particular case, the Supreme Court had before it a situation where the administration, not compelling, not threatening the social media providers, but encouraging them to take down this misinformation. Along the way, the Supreme Court, as I just indicated, finding, once again, a standing problem. And so the Supreme Court says the plaintiffs, without any concrete link between their injuries and the defendant's conduct, ask us to conduct a review of the years-long communications between dozens of federal officials across different agencies with different social media platforms about different topics. Who writes that? That's Amy Coney Barrett, once again, in this case, writing for the majority. And she says this court's standing doctrine prevents us from exercising such a general legal oversight of the other branches of government. The decision is joined by Clarence Thomas, Neil Gorsuch. I'm sorry, it is not joined by them. They are dissenting. Sam Alito, Clarence Thomas, Neil Gorsuch, all dissenting. And in particular, Justice Alito, in dissent on this decision, writes this. He says, high-ranking government officials placed unrelenting pressure on Facebook to suppress America's free speech. Because the court unjustifiably refuses to address this serious threat to the First Amendment, I respectfully dissent. That's the opinion. That's the dissenting non-majority opinion authored by Sam Alito and joined in by Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch. Amy Coney Barrett, again, writing for the majority, goes in just the opposite direction. The case is Murphy versus Missouri, and it arises, again, from some communications from administration officials urging, encouraging platforms to take down posts on things like the coronavirus, the vaccine, the efficacy of things that are good, and the efficacy of things that are not appropriate for addressing COVID-19. Claims of election fraud were the other big category out there. This notion that the 2020 election was somehow stolen. The attorneys general of Missouri and Louisiana had sued, along with three doctors, who the owners of some news websites, and along with a health activist, all of them the plaintiffs in this particular case. They said that many of the government's contacts with the social media companies violated the First Amendment. And although Justice Barrett did not address that argument, again, leaving that for the future, but in a notably sharp footnote, she criticized the Federal District Court for the Western District of Louisiana, which had issued the initial opinion in this case that it enjoined, stopped, and barred further contacts to address what he said could be the most massive attack against free speech in the United States history. Now, again, the Supreme Court rejects that and says that's not the position. And indeed, Justice Barrett, in a majority opinion that says none of this is inappropriate, all of this does not run afoul of any First Amendment provisions here. She says that the lower court's factual findings, many of which unfortunately appear to be clearly erroneous, have given rise to this inappropriate resolution at the lower courts. Among examples was a supposed censorship request from the administration that was cited in the lower court opinion. Justice Barrett goes on to say the record it cites says nothing at all about censorship requests. Rather, she says, in response to a White House official asking Twitter to remove an impersonation account of President Biden's granddaughter, Twitter told the official about a portal that he could use to flag similar issues. In dissent, once again, Justice Alito appeared to accept Judge Doherty's lower court findings along with their implications. All of this, again, sparring at the highest level here. the majority again writing the plaintiffs have failed to overcome at least two daunting hurdles in advocating that somehow this was wrong. She said in their attempt to establish a standing in this particular case, she said the government had caused their injuries and they faced a prospect of future injury. Amy Coney Barrett writing, the first problem was that the social media companies were independent actors with a demonstrated commitment to addressing misinformation before and apart from the government's encouragement. That was one thing that Amy Coney Barrett said in the majority opinion, indicating once again that these communications, nothing wrong with them at all. Second, she said that whatever may have happened in the past, particularly in the midst of the pandemic, a plaintiff seeking an injunction has to demonstrate a real threat of future injury. And again, Chief Justice John Roberts, Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, Brett Kavanaugh, and Ketanji Brown Jackson all join in that majority opinion that finds, once again, that there's nothing wrong with this as well. The significance of this is also that during the course of the oral argument, among them, John Roberts and Brett Kavanaugh, again, supporting this kind of non-coercive, non-threatening engagement between government and a platform provider. During the course of the oral argument, the two of them had quizzed the attorneys for the petitioners here and said, you know, when we were in the White House, and both of them previous lawyers for the White House, said we did this all the time. And they said, if you think about it, members in the political branches, the White House, the Congress, all the time call up news providers, all the time call up platform providers and say, you know, you got something pending there. There's an opinion piece you've written that we do not disagree with. That kind of communication is what is contemplated candidly by the engagement between agencies and entities of the government. And so both Kavanaugh and Roberts, based upon their own prior history, scratch their heads about the very reasons why this case is here. They plainly signal that the standing issue is going to loom large and that in the end, nothing wrong with this. That's exactly what Justice Amy Coney Barrett writes. Of course, there's a distinction between this and another case we talked about earlier called Vulo, in which a government official did, in fact, engage in some coercive communications with people out there in the community, discouraging them, not just discouraging, but also threatening them with some official government conduct. If they engage with the NRA there, the Supreme Court said that you cannot do, can't engage in arguably violent oral behavior, threatening, coercing. And for that reason, in that particular case, the court said that government cannot engage with other parties to try to coerce them to do something as a result of government action. Here, in a case argued on the same day, you get just the opposite result. You get a decision by the Supreme Court, again, authored by Amy Coney Barrett, coming out of the Fifth Circuit, overturning once again the Fifth Circuit's decision on this case that says that indeed government can do this kind of thing as long as it's not, in the language of the other case named Vulo, it cannot be threatening, it cannot be coercive, can be encouraging, urging, and arguing for a removal, arguing for a change in something that's out there. That is what government has done, the majority says, in time immemorial. And in the end, Amy Coney Barrett says this, we begin and we end with standing. At this stage, neither the individual nor the state plaintiffs have established standing to seek what they want. To be sure, the record reflects that the government defendants played a role in at least some of the platform's moderation choices. But the Fifth Circuit, again, taking a shot at them by attributing every platform decision, at least in part to the defendants, glosses over the complexities in this evidence and goes on to explain why it is the Fifth Circuit's decision in this case is simply wrong. Once again, a case where the Fifth Circuit produces a lot of the caseload work of this Supreme Court. In this particular case, once again, Murthy versus Missouri and other states, finding that the government can indeed engage in non-coercive, non-threatening behaviors when it comes to engagement with other entities out there, social media companies. When we come back, more about the United States Supreme Court here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for the Devil's Advocates radio show.
The Todd Alba Show.
Brady joining us live via phone.
I tell the guys before every game, and honestly try to do it before every practice, challenge is going to come. This team is not just going to show up and allow us to walk all over them and win. Really what matters is how are we going to respond to that? Man, if you can adapt and use it as a learning opportunity, it's going to set you up to go accomplish darn near anything you want to.
I think there are a lot of people that need to hear that message today.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. The Maggie Dawn Show.
This broad reaching, well, we can't help people because we can't control how they spend the money, somehow magically doesn't apply to billionaires, doesn't apply to corporations who dodge their taxes every year. The only people who are subject to the conservative morality police are poor people. How dare you?
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. We are spending all of this weekend, both today, Saturday, June 29th, and also tomorrow afternoon, in the afternoon, 2 more hours of analysis of Supreme Court cases. Why? Why are we distributing all of this important information to you? Because it affects America. And these cases, in ways large and small, change the ways in which we interact with each other, especially when it comes, as many of these cases indicate, to our interactions with government and the Supreme Court making decisions about the nature of those relationships as we continue to engage in this great thing called the American experiment. We know, in addition to the cases that it has decided already, that the Supreme Court, again, on Monday of this coming week, is going to decide at least 2 more cases, one of them having to do with social media, the other case, again, involving the immunities that may or may not attach to a sitting president when it comes to the commission of crimes inside the Oval Office. One of the major cases, until once again the decision in the decision to rescind Chevron in this major case involving agency discretion was decided. That immunity case also hugely important. Advocacy today, advocacy at this time for the notion that this case involving the fisheries and the decision to rescind the discretion normally given to under Chevron deference, that is now, from my perspective, once again, the most significant case issued by the Supreme Court, as we have talked earlier in this Saturday broadcast. We know as well the Supreme Court is going to go ahead and begin to populate cases for its next docket coming up in 2024 and 2025. We know already the Supreme Court has agreed just this past Monday to consider a Tennessee law that bans certain medical treatments for transgender minors. The first time the justices will decide on the constitutionality of those kinds of statewide bans. And the case is United States versus Crometti, be heard in the court's next term, typically beginning in October, and no date specifically set for oral argument in that case. We know that the Supreme Court has also got before it a petition by the Justice Department to take on a guns case, as it has in this past term as well, determining whether or not the constitutionality of certain gun restrictions can stand. Wants the court to decide if people convicted of both violent and nonviolent felonies can be barred from having a firearm. The point of all that, the Supreme Court, even as it is resolving these cases on its present docket, also establishing cases for oral argument and for consideration in the coming term, which will begin in October. The Supreme Court does not completely go out of business after this coming Monday. Plainly, it addresses many other things. They remain on the payroll, as we know. But it has always been traditional for the Supreme Court to issue these high ticket, these high visibility cases at this time of the year. And again, what are the major takeaways from this case? SEC versus Jarchese, the Loper-Bright case. It's also tied to this other matter called Relentless. What is the major takeaway from these air pollution cases, the social media cases, and also the cases that we're going to be taking up in our second major broadcast of this weekend? That broadcast, once again, tomorrow afternoon, Sunday afternoon from 2 to 4. The cases there involving a case called Fisher that addresses whether or not the statute under which many, not all, but many of the January 6 rioters have been convicted and charged, also arguably applicable to the Donald Trump election interference prosecution, whether that can stand. We're going to take a look at the abortion decision. Again, a decision in which the Supreme Court sends the case back to the lower courts. We're going to talk about a criminal case involving some corruption, some bribery, maybe gratuities coming out of our own Seventh Circuit, a mayor in Indiana. We're going to talk about homelessness, whether or not a municipality can, in fact, enforce ordinances in a constitutional way to prevent people from living and working and doing other things in public parks and other areas. We're also going to talk about this Purdue Pharma case involving opioids and decision by a bankruptcy court to basically expunge and dismiss many claims in the wake of the opioid crisis. All of those underscoring basic themes that were illustrated, hopefully, in this, our first 2 hours of this weekend, but also in the next 2 hours of these analyses as well. And that is, number one, the incredible power of our court. When you look at some of the subject matter alone, regardless of how you feel about the dispositions of the cases, the areas themselves, I would offer, should be in the area of legislative action. These are things that should, in fact, be debated by our representatives. And in many cases, the Supreme Court says, yes, indeed, we don't want to take on these cases. We should, in fact, be deferring, if you will, to the Congress. Nonetheless, the United States Supreme Court, at least in many of these cases, including this major decision that it issued just this past week in Loper Bright Enterprises, the decision to rescind the Chevron doctrine, there it says we are taking on ourselves the decision to decide what the law is. We're going to interpret that. A huge amount of power in this, the second decade of the 21st century, being vested in our United States Supreme Court. An appropriate discussion going forward for all Americans about the powers of the branches of government, the role of the legislature, the role of the executive branch in executing what the Congress passes. Inside that executive branch, what is the role of our agencies? Now we know, based upon what the Supreme Court has said, their role in administering what the legislature has said, dramatically reduced, wildly reduced, almost to the point of non-existence. What is the role of our branches of government in the wake of these incredible exercises of power by our United States Supreme Court? And should, in fact, they be deciding these major cases that affect all of us? A second major focus here, overruling precedent. We've seen that again in Loper Bright. We've seen that in other cases in the past. Again, the one that many people make reference to, of course, is a couple of years ago this very month, the Supreme Court overruling nearly 50 years of precedent in a Privacy Act case involving Dobbs, and finding that the Supreme Court finding that inside the Constitution there is no longer a privacy right to abortion. A major inclination by this Supreme Court, as other Supreme Courts have done, to overrule precedent, sometimes very appropriately. The question is the Supreme Court over-exercising that authority? And what does that mean for stability when it comes to understanding of what the law is in America today and also in the future? Other things related to the shifting alliances inside the Supreme Court. Lots of interesting things going on with respect to Amy Coney Barrett, not only in the area of historical reference, but also allied with the so-called liberals on the bench in coming to these results. That and many more things to be discussed in our next broadcast of Amicus Law Review, coming to you, yes, that's right, tomorrow afternoon, 2 to 4, as we consider more of the major Supreme Court cases issued by our High Court just this past week. Invitation to join us for that special production tomorrow afternoon here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW. Earl Ingram.
On the next show, it's Motown Monday, and I'll be joined by South Carolina Congressman Jim Clyburn. We'll discuss some of the issues that are impacting you and I every day.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings at 9.
As a federally licensed broadcast company, this Civic Media station is required by FCC regulations to accept advertising by all qualified candidates for federal office. We also accept ads from state and local candidates. We do screen announcements from issue groups and PACs and exercise discretion in airing announcements with blatantly false claims or outrageous unfounded statements. These announcements do not necessarily reflect the views of Civic Media, its hosts, or advertisers, and the source of all issue announcements can be found online at our FCC public file.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app. You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.